Undisclosed comes to you this week thanks to help from The Great Courses, Audible, and Stamps.com. As always, we'll let you know about these great sponsors during the show and how you can support them, thereby supporting Undisclosed. Until then, enjoy the program.
For someone to have shot Isaac Dawkins as he was driving home after his first spring semester class at Floyd College in Rome, Georgia, on January 11, 2000, would have been no easy task. You would have to be in position, ready to follow his car after he left class, be able to make a fatal shot from one moving vehicle into another, at night, no less, make sure no one else saw you, and if lucky, make sure you have an alibi. For the most part, that's what the state argued that Joey did. Our job is to figure out if that was possible. We know Isaac's movements that night, but now it's time to figure out Joey's. As many of you know, Audible is a leading provider of premium digital spoken audio content. If you become an Audible member, you're going to get a free audiobook every single month, exclusive sales of 30% off all regularly priced audiobooks, and unlimited access to channels content. Audible content includes an unmatched selection across the internet of audiobooks, audio shows, news, comedy, and more from leading audiobook publishers. And you can access your Audible content from across a variety of platforms, whether it's a tablet, your smartphone, your laptop. Unlike a streaming or rental device, though, here's the difference. With Audible, you actually own your books. So as I mentioned before, I'm pretty excited about Audible being a sponsor this week because guess what? This is the week that my book comes out, Adnan Story. I've talked about it a number of times. If you follow me on social media, you're seeing news about it all the time, and it's getting a lot of press coverage. And guess what? Audible is carrying it. Not only does Audible have it, but you can actually get it for free. Because if you're an undisclosed listener, you can get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audible.com/undisclosed. Again, it's www.audible.com/undisclosed. Then search for Adnan Story, and there you go. It'll be yours free. You'll have me in your ear for about 10 hours. Of course, other than Adnan Story, Audible carries titles all across the board, from business, classics, fiction, history, romance, mysteries, and thrillers. You can find anything there. And if you don't like it, guess what? Audible has a great listen guarantee. If you didn't like it, you can always swap it. But I have a feeling you're really going to like Adnan's story. So don't miss out on this offer. Once again, to get your free 30-day trial and audiobook, go to www.audible.com/undisclosed. And don't forget to tweet at me and let me know what you think of my book. Welcome to episode 5 of Undisclosed, The State versus Joey Watkins. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney with the Volkov Law Group, and I blog at viewfromll2.com.
I'm Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. In the classic Alfred Hitchcock movie Dial M for Murder, Tony Wendis creates a complicated plan for the murder of his wife while at the same time creating the perfect alibi. He tells a man he's blackmailing where he's hiding a key to his flat. That man will then use that key to enter the flat and murder his wife at 11 o'clock p.m. while she's on the phone and distracted. Meanwhile, at the same time, Wendis will be at a party at a hotel and noticeably use a public phone to place a call at exactly 11 o'clock p.m. to his wife, distracting her and creating an alibi at the same time. Then, after the murder, the other man will make the murder look like it was committed by a burglar. But somehow, despite timing being everything, Wendis is late in making the call. Why? Well, his watch stops, then someone else is using the public phone, so by the time Wendis makes the call, the timing is off, putting into motion a whole new set of plot twists. Now, perfectly plotted alibis compromised by defendants who lose track of time are the kinds of things you usually only see in movies, including A Perfect Murder, the 1998 remake of Dial M for Murder, with a cell phone replacing the hotel phone. And yet, the prosecution at Joey's trial claimed that just such a scenario happened in real life. Let's now turn to Joey's timeline for January 11th, the day that Isaac was shot in his truck.
Joey was questioned about his whereabouts during the day before and after the murder, essentially immediately after it happened. The next day, before noon, the police had indicated they wanted to speak to him, so he has the benefit of having a relatively fixed memory. He was thinking about these events, his timelines, what happened when, less than 24 hours after this occurred. So in that respect, Joey does have the benefit, or what you'd hope would be a benefit, of actually being able to say where he was. Unfortunately, this was also used against him at trial because he seemed to remember too well where he was at the time, and much like Dial M for Murder, the prosecution presented it as a clever plot as opposed to a memory.
So we're actually able to trace Joey's day, starting from when he woke up that morning. It seems as if he began his day by calling his then-girlfriend, Aslan.
Yeah, every morning, or a lot of mornings, Joey and Aslan would talk on the phone, plan their day, decide when they're going to meet up, talk about general stuff. And we know that at 7:24 that morning, Aslan called Joey, and they spoke for about 10 minutes. They made plans, which involved Joey going to see Aslan at her basketball game that evening. At around 11:30 that day, Joey decided he wanted to go visit his uncle in Alabama, who lived in Galesville near Lake Weiss. And Joey had just bought this motorcycle. It was a Katana 600. And as he's put it, he was hell-bent on riding it. Going to Alabama to see his uncle seemed like a good excuse. On the way up, he stopped by and saw his friend Clay. And he asked if Clay wanted to do something that night. Go to Cedartown, whatever. Clay was noncommittal, and Joey drove on and headed up towards Alabama line.
So Joey makes it out to Galesville, which is about 26 miles from his home. And he meets up with his uncle, and they're going to go fishing, right? And so he's actually making calls from his cell phone while he's there in Alabama.
He makes a couple calls. Calls his mom, he gets a call from someone. He doesn't stay too long. At some point, his uncle talks about a new fishing hole they found, and Joey says, hey, let's go fishing. So they go out to the creek. At some point, Joey thinks it's closer towards dark. He decides to leave Uncle Toby's house and head back for Rome. But before he does, Toby says, hey, I got some spots on the lake I want to go check out. Want to come fishing tomorrow? And Joey says, sure. So his uncle says, be there bright and early tomorrow. And Joey gets back on his bike and heads back for Rome. This is from testimony at Mark Free's trial.
Do you recall what time he left?
It was between 5 and 5:30 my time.
So that would be 6:30 Georgia time?
Yes, sir.
All right. Do you recall if he made any statements or comments to you when he left?
He said he had to go home and take a shower and go to a ball game.
And as far as we can tell from Joey's memory, he remembers arriving home around nighttime, around when it was getting dark. Sunset in Rome on January 11th, 2000 was about 5:50. And Joey arrives home. When he gets there, he sees his sister Tandy and Tandy's boyfriend Tim Hughes. And then that starts a very important sequence of phone calls that are relevant to this case. And the first one of these is a 6:43 p.m. call that Joey makes to his girlfriend Aslan's pager. And then Aslan returns that call, making a call to the Watkins household at 6:48 p.m.
So we know for a fact that Joey got home by 6:44 that evening, because that's when he pages Aslan, and no one else would have been paging Aslan from that phone. About 4 minutes later, Aslan calls back. Everyone agrees that Tim, which is Joey's sister's boyfriend, actually answered the phone. Now, Joey has always said, and initial notes from others all agree, that Joey's about to jump in the shower. So Tim hands him the phone, he briefly talks to Aslan, and then he runs up and gets the shower, gets ready to go see her. At this point, possibly during that phone call at 6:48, Aslan mentions that she was still sick. She'd been sick earlier. And in fact, she was so sick that she couldn't make her second game. Her dad had to drive her home because after the JV game, she was unable to play anymore. So instead of the plans they originally had to meet at the basketball game, she says, come to my house. I'll be there. And Joey says, sure, I'll be down in a bit.
Susan, do we have the home phone records? Did the state pull them to confirm the 6:43 call to her pager and then her return call?
Yeah, they pulled them pretty early in the case. I don't know if necessarily anyone recall the exact time that Joey had paged Aslan, but they both remember talking to each other that evening. And when they got the phone records, it showed that at 6:44, that's when Joey's home phone line paged Aslan's pager. And at 6:48 is when Aslan's home phone calls back on Joey's home line. Now, for some reason I'm still not actually entirely sure about, there is confusion over this at trial. Tammy Colston, the prosecutor, repeatedly expresses confusion or skepticism, or for some reason she doesn't believe that the 6:48 call occurred. And I'm not entirely sure yet why that confusion happened, because it's in the phone records that the state had, so it's pretty black and white. This is what Tammy Colston said in closing arguments. In reference to that 6:48 call, she says, "It is not on the cell phone records that I see at all. But look and see. If it's there and if it says 6:48, that's fine. Say Aslan called at 6:48. Aslan told you positively and absolutely to Joey Watkins that Tim Hughes answered the phone and Joey Watkins was on his way out the door. Tim called him back. She hadn't no doubt about that, none whatsoever. He called back on the phone. He was already on his way. And if you take the defense's time at 6:48, he is already on his way to Cedartown then." But here's where the minor discrepancy comes up. According to the defense, when that 6:48 call from Aslan came in, Tim answered, said, "Hold on, I'll grab Joey." Joey says that he said, "Oh, I'm jumping in the shower. I'll call you on my way down." Aslan sort of kind of testifies, after giving different statements earlier, that when this happened, Joey didn't say he was jumping in the shower. He said he was already on his way, as in he was actually physically walking out the door at 6:48 p.m. Here's why this matters. If Joey leaves at 6:48 p.m., that gives him 27 minutes extra than does his timeline, because Joey says that he walked out the door at 7:15, aka the time he made a phone call to Aslan on his cell phone.
It could be that Aslan is getting confused with the next call on the record, which is a 7:15 p.m. call, and it also happens to be the call that Joey says he was on the phone with her while he was walking out of the door. So she could have gotten those two calls confused.
Yeah, and it's pretty clear that she doesn't have, like, an ironclad memory of, like, each sequence of phone calls. She remembers that, like, he called her and she called him. It turns out one of those calls was a page, but that's not, like, a weird mix-up to have. So given that Joey from the very beginning was saying he was jumping in the shower, and Tim was saying from the very beginning that he was jumping in the shower, I don't find this one to be materially in dispute. Besides, we know that at about 7 o'clock, Joey's parents came home. And according to Joey's dad, he has a memory of walking in and being pissed at Joey because Joey had parked his katana, his motorcycle, in the spot where his parents parked.
Sandy and Tim were there. I parked my bike in the garage. And when I came in, I can't remember if I got on the phone or not. I may have got on the home phone. But I came in, Sandy and Tim were there. And I had got in the shower. And I could hear my mom and dad when they came in. And my dad was raising Cain about my bike being in the under the carport. And I think Aslan called or something while I was in the shower, something of that nature. And Mama told me to call her when I was coming out. And my daddy said something about, I think it was feed the dogs or something. And I went and got the dog food out of the car or whatever. And I was wanting to ride my bike. My dad was like, "You're not going to ride your bike." So he's like, "You're driving your truck." And I was like, "Fine." And then Mama told me to call Aslan. She called, so I was calling her as I was walking out the door. I remember that like it was yesterday. I was dialing her number when I was coming out the door. And when I got in my truck, I think she may have picked up when I got in my truck. I can't remember exactly. But I left there, and I drove my normal route.
So the next call on the phone record is a 7:15 p.m. call. And this is kind of an important call to me because this is the time, remember, when Isaac would have been getting out of his class. We don't know for sure if he got out a little bit early, but 7:15 is when that class ended. And if we are to buy the state's argument, or at least one of them, that means at 7:15, when Joey is on the phone, he should have been in position, I guess, at the college to ambush Isaac or to follow him or something.
They want to make that at one point because in order to make the state's semblance of a theory at all work, this had to be a pre-planned murder. There's no version of what the state argues that is remotely plausible, coherent, or believable unless it's based on an assumption that Joey intended to do this murder, plotted it out. I mean, the state does throw out suggestions saying, "Oh, maybe he saw him and got mad." But if you look at the facts they're actually arguing, if you look at like the various pieces of things they claim occurred, there's no question. This was a pre-planned murder. because Joey had to have switched out cars to make sure he wasn't riding the truck when he did it, had to meet up with Mark, had to put an alibi in place instantly. It couldn't have been an accident, which means Joey presumably had a plan for meeting Isaac. Now, Isaac's class was supposed to get out at 7:15. As we learned last episode, it may have been a bit earlier because it's the first day. But if Joey's committing this murder, things are getting into gear at the very latest by 7:15. So why is he calling his girlfriend?
Right, so he's calling his girlfriend then. But I mean, not only does he have to know what time the class ends, but he also would actually have to know that Isaac is like registered for the class. Like, how does he know?
It's the first day of class. No one really knows Isaac's schedule. They later try and like find ways that Joey could have had knowledge of it. Like they ask Brianne, oh, did you ever ask Samantha about Isaac's schedule and then pass it on to Tandy? You could have passed it on to Joey. But there isn't a coherent way that Joey could have known that Isaac had out of class 7:15.
Yeah, if we're breaking everything down, Joey's story is, I'm making the 7:15 call as I'm walking out of my house, which obviously, if he is trying to commit this murder, he is extremely late, and it's inconceivable that he would have gotten to Floyd College and Isaac's truck in time to shoot him. The state's theory, I suppose, is either he's on his way to Floyd College and is late. It's sort of the Dial M for Murder scenario where he had this plan but somehow is running really late. Or the other scenario is he's sort of sitting there at Floyd College waiting to follow Isaac and decides, I'm going to call my girlfriend and talk to her for about 4 minutes while I guess he's then seeing Isaac leave and then following him and shooting him during this phone call.
Because that's the thing. This phone call lasts 4 minutes and 23 seconds. There is no way that I can see for the murder to not have occurred during the span of that call. It had to have, because, well, for a lot of reasons. Basically, giving the state every single benefit of the doubt in terms of the timeline, assuming that the smallest possible periods of time pass, assuming that everything works perfectly in their favor, the latest this murder could have possibly occurred is about 7:18:50, 7:19:00, and that's being generous. That is the latest possible moment that Isaac could have been shot. But that phone call from Joey lasted 4 minutes and 23 seconds. Now, we don't know what the second the call was made on because the phone records only give minutes. So we only know from Joey's records that the phone call was initiated at 7:15 p.m. However, we know from Aslan's phone records that she didn't answer the phone until 7:16 p.m., which means that at some point during the 7:15:01 to 7:15:59, Joey started that call. Sometime after 7:16:01 is when Aslan picked it up. Assuming, not unreasonably, that it took no more than 30 seconds for Aslan to answer the phone, that means that Joey was calling no earlier than 7:15:30, which means, under any universe, he was talking to Aslan at least until 7:19:53.
And if we believe that, given all the benefits to the state, that this is a time span in which Isaac had to have been shot by, what we have to then believe is that Joey was not only on his phone and not only driving at the same time, but also was shooting as he's on the phone and driving.
Or had an accomplice with him. Under any scenario, though, at the moment that gun was fired that killed Isaac, Joey was talking to Aslan. Aslan heard nothing. Aslan heard nothing abnormal, heard nothing out of the ordinary, had no indication that Joey was not alone, had no indication that Joey had fired a gun. And by the time it got to trial, Aslan was not Joey's biggest fan, to put it mildly. She was not inclined to give Joey any benefits of the doubt, let alone lie in his favor. There's no suggestion that she's covering up something here or that she's not telling the full truth when she says she heard nothing. And of course, if you're the state, you just say, well, Aslan was really sick. She was really sick. She might not have heard a gunshot because she was just, you know, she was just sick as a dog.
We're going to take a quick break right now just to check in with one of our sponsors.
You know that feeling you get when you can get things done with just the click of your mouse? It can't get more convenient than that. And now, you can even get your mailing and shipping done without leaving your desk, thanks to Stamps.com. Stamps.com turns your PC or Mac into your own personal post office that never closes. It's so convenient. You can buy and print official US postage for any letter or package right from your computer and printer. Then you just hand the mail to your mailman or drop it in the mailbox. You'll never have to go to the post office again. I'm always sending out articles to colleagues, lawyers, and judges. I'm making requests to courts for documents. And using Stamps.com is so easy and saves me so much time. And right now, you can sign up for Stamps.com and use our promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. It's a 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in undisclosed. That's stamps.com, enter undisclosed.
In case you haven't realized it, Susan, Colin, and myself are great believers in lifelong learning, and we're pretty sure our listeners are too. That's why you hang in there week after week as we dive deep and teach you new things about the law and criminal procedure. So that's why we are big fans of and very excited with our sponsor this week, The Great Courses Plus. The Great Courses Plus takes learning a step farther by giving you this amazing, engaging video lecture series, hundreds of them presented by top professors on so many different topics. You have demand access to so many lectures that offer a wealth of knowledge. You can stream them anytime and on any device. There's nothing they don't cover, whatever could interest you. American history, civil rights, cooking, photography, and hey, if you listen to Undisclosed, I'm guessing the law. And the lecture series I just started diving into, I'm pretty sure you guys are going to love. It's called Forensic History, Crimes, Frauds, and Scandals. And listen to the description here. Modern history is filled with terrible crimes, baffling hoaxes, and seedy scandals. The infamous Jack the Ripper slayings, the alleged arrival of Anastasia Romanov, the youngest daughter of the murdered Tsar, 7-time Tour de France winner Lance Armstrong's public fall from grace, the Chicago Tylenol poisonings, and the copycat crimes that followed. From the Black Dahlia murder to Hollywood deaths to political assassinations, 24 different episodes in this one series. It's going to keep you busy and fascinated for hours. So right now, as one of our listeners, if you sign up for the Great Courses Plus, you will get a month free of unlimited access to all of their lectures. So start your month free today. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed, and enjoy your learning.
Let's now turn to the next sequence of calls on Joey's call log. The next one's at 7:21 p.m., so that's about 1 to 3 minutes after Isaac Dawkins has been shot, according to any reasonable timeline. So at 7:21, he makes a phone call to his house, and he's asking for Uncle Toby's phone number. So according to the state, Joey or his accomplice has just killed Isaac Dawkins, and just a couple minutes later, he's making this calm call to his home and asking for the number for Uncle Toby.
This is from testimony at Mark Free's trial.
When your brother called you back after he had left, what did he want to talk about?
The first time or the second time?
You said he left at 7:15. Mm-hmm. Okay, he made two calls. Mm-hmm. First time, what do you want to talk about?
He wanted to know my uncle's phone number.
Do you know why?
I think because the next day he was going to go fishing with him. He and Tim had planned on going fishing. I think he was going to call him and ask him if it was okay if Tim came too. Because I know he was planning on going fishing.
And you couldn't get that for him?
Well, I was upstairs. At the time, the house that we lived in, there were 3 levels to our house. And I was watching TV and I was just really, I guess, being lazy. And I didn't know it off the top of my head, so I wasn't going to go look for it. I just said, I don't know.
Then 2 minutes after that, at 7:23 p.m., he's making a call, another call on his call log. This one's to his grandmother, and again, he, according to Joey, is asking for Uncle Toby's phone number. Then finally, he makes a third call again at 7:23 p.m., and this is a call seemingly having gotten Uncle Toby's phone number. The call is made to Uncle Toby, And this phone call, according to Joey, is him asking Uncle Toby if Tim Hughes, again, his sister's boyfriend, could come fishing with them the next day.
Now, this is on the 11th. Do you recall receiving any subsequent phone call from Joey that day or that evening?
That afternoon, I did. Later after he left, he called to ask me if it'd be all right if Tim can come down fishing with us the next morning.
I know when you say that afternoon, he left your time around 5 or 5:30. Yeah.
It was later than that.
All right. So, B, would you say this would be early evening?
Yes, sir.
And if I suggest to you that the time was around 7:23 Georgia time, would that you dispute that?
No, sir.
I mean, 6:23 Alabama time.
I don't know exactly what time.
Okay.
And according to Joey, his uncle said he didn't care, but he didn't have another life vest. So if he's bringing Tim, bring in a life vest too. Here's Joey describing what he remembers about that night and his drive down to Cedartown.
So I called my grandmother, got the number, then I called Toby. And he told me it was okay. And the whole time I'm doing this, I was driving. So I go past the Ford store, and I get by the little where you can turn to go to town or whatever. And then you can keep going left and go towards Cedartown. And I think that's when the ambulance went by me. And I actually had to pull over. And then I got on down. And when I got on down, I remember there was an officer. He was in the road already with a flashlight. He was had traffic, you know, directing traffic. And I actually had to stop. And he was waving everybody by one at a time. The ambulance was there, and the fire trucks were there. And there were some cars off to the side of the road. I remember that.
What do you remember seeing when you drove by?
When I pulled up to where the truck was off the road or whatever, like I said, the officer was flagging everybody. Everybody had to stop. He was stopping everybody and, like, directing everybody around. He was standing in the right-hand lane, and he was directing everybody around in the inside lane. And you had to stop right where it was at. And that's when I looked over, and I seen it looked like his truck.
That was from an interview earlier this year, in 2016. But back in 2000, about a month after Isaac's murder, he talked to the Rome Police Department and gave a statement. And they asked him about how he'd recognize Isaac's truck that night. The quality isn't great, but here's his answer from his original interview.
Are you familiar with Isaac's truck?
Somewhat.
What made you think it might be his? Just the markings and whatever on it?
The markings, and I seen kind of like a brush guard because his headlights were still on, and I seen something like a brush guard in the front of his truck, and I knew his truck had a brush guard with wild lights on it. That's about all I know.
Okay. Okay, at that point, what did you do? What'd you pass the
accident? Right as I passed the accident, I called my sister. I told her it looked like, you know, it looked like Isaac's truck, but he may have had a wreck. She might want to call his sister.
So the next call on the phone record is a 727 call that Joey makes to his sister Tandy. And he calls her because he says that he thinks Isaac might have been in a wreck. And he says, hey, do you want to call Samantha and ask her if everything's okay or if she knows what's going on? Samantha, remember, is Samantha Dawkins, and that's Isaac's sister. So Joey is telling his sister, hey, maybe you want to check in with Samantha.
And this is essentially the state claiming that Joey is trying to be sort of too cute by half, where, you know, his claim is, look, I saw Isaac's truck by the side of the road. I was concerned. I called my sister Tandy. Whereas the state's claim is this is, you know, braggadocio, where he's done this and to try to sort of create this fake alibi. Well, why would I call my sister and say I saw Isaac's truck if I shot him? And that's the state's claim, where he is this criminal mastermind, where, you know, obviously the logical thing to do if you had shot him would be to keep your mouth shut and not say anything. But Joey obviously is calling his sister and saying, look, I think Isaac crashed and maybe you want to call his sister.
So this is kind of crazy to me, because for me, I mean, if mastermind or not, I mean, like, if you just, you know, if he's like responsible for this crime, the last thing he'd want to do is to call people and place himself right at the scene of the crime. I would think, if anything, if he's trying to create an alibi, he would, if he's going to call, he'd put himself as far away as possible and say, hey, I'm on the other side of town, instead of saying that he's happens to be right by the place this guy's shot.
I guess if you're the state, you say, well, Joey had told friends that morning that he'd be driving to Cedartown that afternoon. He told his girlfriend he's driving to Cedartown to see her. He's told his family he's leaving to go to Cedartown. So everyone and their dog knows that Joey was driving to Cedartown sometime that evening. So given that he couldn't avoid that fact, why not, I guess, make it even more explicit?
And so the state's theory is that he would have driven south, gotten to Floyd College or made a U-turn before, gone north and shot Isaac, and then done another U-turn to head back down south. Is that right?
That's one eventual theory they come up with, that he drove south to the college, came back north, turned around again after, it depends on the story, but doing something, and then driving south again.
Right. But for him to have killed Isaac, he would have had to have been driving north at some point. He would have had to change direction.
Yes. There's no question that if Joey did this, he was driving northbound at the time. He had to be doing a lot of driving. But you know what? Joey's not the only one who recalls this. Here is Tandy at Mark's trial talking about what she remembers of when Joey called her and what happened then.
When Joey left right at 7:15, called you the first time, and then called you the second time. What was that about?
The second time he called and asked me if I knew if Isaac's truck had a toolbox.
Why would he call you about Isaac? If they were not on good terms, do you know why he would call you about Isaac?
Because he seen his truck on the side of the road. And he knew who he was. He thought he seen a truck that he thought was his. And he called me to ask me if it had a toolbox, if I knew if it had a toolbox or not.
Asked you if it had a toolbox or not.
Mm-hmm.
Joey told you that he saw a toolbox on the truck?
No, he asked me, does Isaac's truck have a toolbox?
That's okay, he asked you if Isaac's truck had a toolbox. So, did he say that he saw a toolbox on this truck?
He didn't say. He just asked.
He asked if it had a toolbox. Did he ask you anything else about Isaac?
No, he didn't.
About the truck?
No, sir.
Did he indicate to you how he knew that this might be Isaac's truck?
He didn't say. He just said, does Isaac's truck have a toolbox? And I said, I don't know. He said, you don't know. And I said, well, I'll ask Tim. Tim was right beside me. And I asked Tim, and Tim said, I think so. I don't really remember. And he said, well, I think he had a wreck. And I said, what, you know, and he said, I seen him on the side of the road. And I said, well, did you stop? I mean, I knew they weren't friends, but you see somebody. And I said, did you stop to see if he needed any help? And he said, no, the ambulance and everything was already there.
Yeah, so again, that is Tandy testifying at Mark Freeh's trial. And again, the state's theory, although it's not really concrete, was that Joey was driving while Mark Freeh, his accomplice, shot Isaac Dawkins. And that's relevant because the next call on Joey's call log is a 7:35 p.m. call. He says that's a call to ask them to see if she needs anything because he stopped in Cedartown to buy a Gatorade for her. And at that point, he saw an individual by the name of Ryan Lovelace. And what we do know is that Ryan was interviewed by the defense in this case, and the notes from that interview indicate Ryan Lovelace, Cedartown, 7:30 to 7:40 p.m. by himself. So clearly Ryan is telling the defense that Joey was by himself when he saw him between 7:30 and 7:40 p.m.
Here's Aislinn testifying at Mark Freeh's trial about the cell phone call she received from Joey that night and about him arriving at her place that evening.
Was this a call made to that phone number by Joey Watkins?
Yes.
And you recall the time it was made?
Around 7:15.
Okay. And did he subsequently make another phone call within the next
15 minutes?
And what was the purpose of that call?
See if I wanted Gatorade.
Excuse me?
To see if I needed Gatorade.
Okay, so he called you. And did he bring you some?
Yes.
And you called what time he arrived in Cedartown?
Around 8:30. I think it's closer to 8.
Okay. And do you remember what vehicle he arrived in?
White truck.
So Joey gets the Gatorade, keeps heading down, and eventually drives up to Aslan's house. And Aslan's father sees him arrive in his white truck. And Aslan's in her bed because she's sick, but she heard Joey arrive, and she knew for a fact that that was Joey's truck that he pulled up in. So both Aslan and her father knew that Joey had arrived a little after 8-ish, in the white truck that his sister's boyfriend, and his parents saw him leave in. Now, a white truck is a pretty different car from a little four-door Honda. That's blue.
Right, and remember, the eyewitness to the incident that we think led to Isaac's death actually saw a little blue Honda weaving in and out, in the lanes with Isaac's truck, and apparently there was some aggressive driving between the two.
And unless you think that Benson confused interaction between two white little pickups for an interaction between a white pickup and a little blue sedan, Joey wasn't driving that truck when the shooting happened, if he's the killer. In the first days after the shooting, first month or so, the cops try and talk to Aslan and her parents repeatedly. Aslan's parents don't want her talking to the cops. They don't want that happening. They give limited statements to the police. And they always say the same thing. Joey came down, he acted normal, there's nothing weird, and then he went home. He didn't stay too long, it's maybe 10 o'clock. But it's very clear from those initial interviews that nothing was out of place or nothing was odd. They had nothing of concern to say about what Joey did that night, what he said that night. He was just normal. Sometime around 9:40-ish, he heads back home to Rome. And once again, he passes by the truck. This time he's headed northbound, but he remembers looking over and seeing Isaac's truck still in the woods with some cones out around it, and things had died down by that point. It was no longer all the police and ambulances that were there when he first went down. But he sees it again, and then he continues home. So no later than 10:24, he's home, and he calls Aslan to let her know he got home safely. And his memory of that night is that he turned on MTV and watched the music video for Kryptonite by Three Doors Down.
All right, let's now turn to the next day, January 12th, 2000. Looking at Joey's call log, we have some calls at about 6 a.m., one of these is to Tim Hughes, again, the boyfriend of his sister, and it's planning the fishing trip that day. And thereafter, Joey, according to his story, takes a trip out to Alabama, and that he, in fact, is out on a boat and fishing when his parents call him and tell him about Isaac's death.
So Joey left about 6:30, calls Tim Hughes, picks him up, and they head out to Lake Weiss, get there pretty early. He remembers stopping to buy a fishing license at a stop up there, and everything's fine. They're all out on the lake when around 11:30-ish, he gets a text from his mom. It says 911, like, emergency, call me. So he calls, and she says, Isaac's been shot. The police want to talk to you.
So once Joey gets these calls and he realizes it's a serious situation, he decides to go back to Rome, and he leaves, but he has to pick up his sister, Tandy, from school first, so he swings by the high school, and when he gets there, he runs into some people and he has a conversation with a few folks. Of course, there's Tandy, but there's also a teacher named Mr. Miller, and there's a young lady named Jessica who happens to be a good friend of Brianne's, and we think this happened around 1:15 p.m.
When Joey walks into the school, they are all talking about Isaac's death. It's in Mr. Miller's class, and when they stop in to pick Tandy up, they join the conversation. And so Tandy's talking, and Tandy tells Jessica at some point and says, yeah, Joey called me when he was going down to Cedartown that night and saw his truck and run off the road but didn't stop. And later on, this gets conveyed to Brianne by Jessica and through Brianne to the police.
Jessica, if I would, I'd like to take you back to around January the 12th. You were at Coosa Valley Tech in school, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And when you were at school, some people showed up at the school. And just in your own words, just tell me the whole story about who showed up and what happened from there.
Joey Watkins and Tim came into class while we were all sitting around talking about the death of Isaac. And Joey had made the statement that they didn't like each other, but that he didn't do it. And then he told me that the night that it happened, he was coming home from Cedartown, saw a truck off in the woods, called Tandy to see what Isaac's truck had looked like, and she described it to him, and he said, well, I saw it in the woods, but I didn't stop to help him because we don't get along.
Did he say anything else about the truck being in the woods, like an accident or anything like that?
That was all he said.
That's all he said. And when he told that to you, were y'all like in the hallway, in the classroom? What was the setting?
We were in the classroom.
As we discussed previously, Joey was a suspect pretty quickly. Actually, before Isaac was dead, he was a suspect. That night, Isaac's friends and family began saying, oh, Joey. Joey's the one who probably did this. Joey's the one with the motive. So the cops zero in on him, basically instantly. And the next day, on the 12th, Detective Moser from the Rome Police Department is already going to the Watkins house. He goes out there later in the afternoon. Joey's not home yet. Tandy just gotten back from the hospital, where she went with some classmates to see Isaac. And Moser starts asking her questions. She's the only one home. And when Moser gets there, he sees that there's a white truck, Joey's truck, and a little tealish Pontiac Sunfire.
How are you so sure that Joey was at home from 6:43 to 7:15 p.m. on January the 11th of 2000?
Because I was at home when he got there, and I was at home when he left.
But when did that become a critical issue for you to know that? How long after the Isaac Dawkins case did you become aware that you were going to have to know those particular times?
The very next day.
Why?
Because Jim Moser came to my house and was asking me questions like, is your brother home? And, you know, saying that he needed to speak with him.
And so Moser starts asking Tandy, who drives that car? It's your car? Does Joey ever drive it? Who drives it? And Tandy says, no, it's my car. I don't let him drive it. He's not on insurance. He doesn't drive it.
So before this happens, Joey had gone to pick his sister up from school, and apparently he doesn't pick Tandy up. She instead ends up going to the hospital, and he ends up going somewhere else.
They changed plans because he was going to get Tandy. Tandy says, I want to go to the hospital and see Isaac.
So at this point, Moser is at the house talking to Tandy, but Joey is not yet home.
No, he's not home there. No one's home but Tandy. But Moser asked Tandy to have Joey call him. And the next day, that morning or that afternoon, Joey calls back and they set up an interview for early in the morning on the 13th. Now, I think the way Joey put it was his dad was being a dad and he was upset about what happened with Moser. He thought it was, I guess, from his perspective, he had this detective come up and start questioning his teenage daughter about whether her car could have been used in the murder plot. And he gets offended that it was Detective Moser and not a detective or police officer that he knew or was on more familiar terms with that had actually reached out to him. So he says because of the way Moser was questioning Tandy, he's not going to let Joey speak to the officers until Joey has his attorney present. So the interview gets canceled. But here are Moser's notes when he has his phone call with Johnny. It says, due to me going to his home, questioning Tandy about her car, not having Mike or Marshall Smith call him, Johnny said that Bill O'Dell needs to be present during this interview. And at the end of Moser's notes, it says that Johnny apparently said to him, Joey could not have done that to Isaac because Joey was at home with him. And then in Moser's handwriting, it says alibi with two exclamation points in big letters. And alibi puts three others that Joey was at home on 11100. Now at trial, this is going to be used against Joey as evidence that he'd been lying about an alibi or got his dad to lie about an alibi because, oh, we all know that Joey was driving down to Cedartown. So clearly he asked his dad to lie for him and say he wasn't going to Cedartown. Johnny denies that he said this to Moser, but it's in the notes. What I think likely happened is that they actually believed Joey was at home at the time of the murder because they knew that, of course, Joey was going down to Cedartown. There was never any attempt to make that a secret. He was telling everyone about it. So my guess is that Johnny was literally answering the question of where was Joey at the time of the murder, as opposed to where Joey was that night in general.
And I mean, I can imagine. I mean, look, we're talking about a very short time span, right? Like 10, 15, 20 minutes at the most. And I can imagine that for Johnny, I mean, his father, he doesn't know exactly when Isaac's been shot. You know, in his head, he's probably just estimating around the time and he's thinking, oh yeah, Joey was home around that time. And even the police wouldn't have known at that point. You know, so I don't think it was something that he was doing on purpose or contriving. I think he just figured that his son probably was home around that time because he had seen him in the evening. But what I find interesting about this is, you know, whether it's the phone calls that Joey makes or his father, I mean, these are alibis basically for him. And instead of the alibis being helpful, it's almost like the state is turning these alibis against him. I mean, they are turning it against him. So it's like, if he didn't have an alibi, he'd be screwed. But he has an alibi, and that's nefarious, too.
That's why you don't talk to the cops. No. but that's exactly what happened. It's exactly what happened. Because a month later, not even a month later, in early February, Joey does have an interview with the police. And his attorney's present, and he talks to them on the record. That's what the taped interview was earlier, you heard, from his interview with Mike Key.
One thing I do remember is when I did the interview with Mike Key and Bill O'Dell, during that interview, Mike Key was cutting the recorder on and off and telling me don't say fix this, that, and other because they'll turn it around and use it against you. And Mike Key was telling me, I've seen your phone records. I've seen this. I know you didn't do this. And he was telling me don't say specific things because they'll turn it around on you.
Wait, Mike Key was trying to help you or trying to...
Yes, he was trying to help me.
So he was stopping the thing, being like, don't say that, you're going to regret that, or...
Yeah. No, he was like, just tell me, you know, exactly what you've seen and all, but don't say times and don't say, like, oh, this hubcap was turned to the right, you know, just don't say specific things. He was turning it on and off. He was telling me that they were after me. For this.
Did you know Mike Key? Why would he be doing this?
I think my dad and Mike Key were kind of... I knew him, you know, from my dad. He had been to the lot a couple times to see my dad. When they were doing, like, drug bust or stuff like that in South Rome, he would come and he would, like, get a car from my dad and ride down here and bring the car back.
What he says in that interview is used against him. It's played in full at trial. They use it to try and, like, destroy him. From his perspective, he's just going in and giving an account of where he was, what he did. It doesn't matter what he said. Anything he said would have been ammo for the prosecution.
Yeah, and we can see that with the call to his sister, because the state's argument at trial is, look, it's well known that Joey hated Isaac, and therefore, when Joey says, I called my sister because I thought I saw him by the side of the road in a wreck, that had to be a lie, because everyone knows Joey hated Isaac so much, so why would he have acted out of concern for Isaac by calling his sister and telling her she might want to call Isaac's sister?
And I remember seeing the brush guard. I know in my trial, she said the brush guard was over here, over there. I don't think it was. I remember seeing that brush guard near the front of that truck. That's when I called my sister and told her, but I thought it was probably Isaac's truck. She might want to call Samantha.
So why would you call your sister?
I mean, just to let her know that it looked like his truck.
But was she friends with Isaac, or?
No, she was friends with Samantha. Tandy, my sister, Samantha and Brianne have been friends since, like, third grade. So
you wouldn't have called Samantha, so you wanted Tandy to do it for you or something?
Yeah, because, I mean, me and Isaac weren't on good terms or whatever. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, you know, you need to call blah, 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 blah. It wasn't like that. I just kind of called her and I was like, hey, man, you know, looks like Isaac had a wreck. I think it's his truck.
The evidence they used to show that Joey had this pathological hatred of Isaac is messed up on its own. But then to say that it's proof that he's lying because he hated Isaac so much, he wouldn't have even taken the time to say, hey, Tandy, let Isaac's family know he might have had a wreck or gone off the road. I mean, he knew Isaac. They'd grown up together. I think Tammy Colston really did see the case that way, maybe.
I mean, it's a ridiculous argument. I mean, we're talking about, first of all, high school kids, but even if not, it's a small town. And if you think you saw something, you know, something happened to somebody, you know, I mean, the first kind of impulse is to, oh, gosh, who do we reach out and tell? Nowadays, kids will immediately, you know, or people just forget kids. I mean, we all just, you know, want to share information, be the first one to know something and tell somebody else something, and they'll text each other, call each other. I don't know. I don't think there's anything weird about that at all. And I don't think it matters, like, what kind of relationship you have with that person.
But, like, even this gets used against him, because in the notes from the police, at one point they start, like, writing their list of reasons why Joey's guilty. And they're like, why didn't Joey call anyone else? Wouldn't he have called someone else if there'd been a wreck and he had a cell phone? So it doesn't matter what he says. Either way, it's getting used against him. The other way. I think that in many respects, the crux of the state's case is the 721 and 727 phone calls. Both of those phone calls are to Joey's own home. The first one, he was calling to find his Uncle Toby's number, and Tandy said, "I don't know it. I don't want to go find it. Call your grandma. She'll tell you." And in the second one, he's calling about the wreck. So there are two phone calls to his home phone number. And then when Joey goes in to talk to Mike Key and tells the story about how he passed the rec site and called Tandy, the cops zero in on the fact there's a 721 call. And they ignore the 727 call and say, in his statement to Mike Key, Joey told Mike he didn't leave his house until 720. If he left his house at 720, the time of the incident, how and why was he on the cell phone calling his dad at 721? And they also go on to say, at 721, there were no police on the scene. There was no ambulance on the scene. There was none of the stuff Joey describes on the scene. Therefore, he's lying.
So they're confusing the 728 call with the 721 p.m. call.
Yeah. And it's a really simple answer. Like, the 721 call is not the call he's talking about. So that turns into evidence against him, which the thing is, it's remarkable how accurate Joey's description of what he saw at the 727 call is with the timeline of the police. Because what Joey describes at 727, which is the time he passed Isaac's wreck, what he sees at the side of the road, what he sees the police, the ambulances, the fire trucks, that was all there. We know from the radio logs, we know from the police reports, that at that moment that he says he passes Isaac's wreck, all the things he describes were present. In fact, he even describes as he's pulling onto 27, he's cut off by an ambulance heading down to the wreck site. Now, I don't see any viable possibility that this didn't happen the way Joey says. Sure, the state can argue he'd like loop back around and was driving back south again, but I don't see any scenario under which Joey could have known the movements of the ambulance well enough to predict where the ambulance would be at 7:25 p.m. We know when the ambulance left the Floyd Medical Center, and we know when it arrived at the wreck site, and Joey's story about where he encountered it matches perfectly.
Right, and we know from the radio logs that the cops had arrived at this scene and shut down the outside lane by the rec site at 7:25 p.m., which would have been right before, again, Joey made this 7:27 call. So, yeah, I mean, what he says timing-wise syncs pretty well with him arriving at the rec site at about 7:27 p.m., seeing the cops having closed down the lane, then thereafter, a little bit afterwards, seeing the ambulance on the way, whereas if Joey was involved in the killing and then turns around and is driving south again, he wouldn't have seen the cops showing up. He would have been past the point where the ambulance would have gotten in the area. So it's kind of confusing to see how the state's theory could hold any water because the timing just wouldn't work.
Joey says he left his house at 7:15 and called his girlfriend as he's leaving, and that he passed the wreck at 7:27, and he called his sister again to say, "Hey, I just saw Isaac's truck." Now, there were many, many test drives done in this case, but one of the very first test drives Mosher did was to drive from Joey's house to the wreck site, and it fit perfectly. As in, if Joey was leaving his house at 7:15 when he called Aslan, he would have passed the wreck at 7:27 when he made that call to his sister.
And the state's theory pretty much has to be, right, that Joey was involved in the shooting and then stuck around for maybe 8-9 minutes more, waited for the police to arrive so he could describe that, unless he's just sort of in his mind coming up with, well, cops will arrive eventually and there'd be an ambulance. But, I mean, their theory kind of has to have him to make any sense, just committing the shooting, then just hanging around and waiting for everything to arrive before then.
I think that theory would involve him either dropping off his accomplice, whoever the favorite accomplice of the moment was, or changing out his cars or something. So I guess he could have driven somewhere and then driven back down south again.
Would he have had time to double back to his house, drop off his sister's car, and then get his truck?
Oh, no.
That would be about 12 minutes, right? So 24 minutes
round
trip.
It's minutes.
According to what you just said, yeah.
Yeah. So they later try and argue that, or not even argue, because it doesn't make much sense, but they make references to the fact that, oh, he could have gone to one of his father's car lots and traded out a car there and come back down.
Is the car lot closer? His parents' car lot?
Yeah, that's closer. But still, the timing. Well, we'll get into this later, but let's just say that particular argument doesn't really concern me much. Here is from the police notes when they're explaining all the reasons why they think Joey's lying. And it says, in a statement to Mike Key, Joey told Mike that he called his sister to tell her that he saw Isaac wrecked on the side of the road. He told Mike Key that he was stopped in the traffic and a police officer was working traffic and only one lane was open. The two calls that Joey made to his house was at 7:21 and 7:27. Joey also said that he said that the ambulance passed him going to the scene. The ambulance didn't arrive on the scene until 7:26, and the police weren't on the scene at 7:22. The first call to his house to tell his sister that Isaac was in a wreck could not have happened because the police had not arrived at the scene yet. The second call at 7:27 could have been the one where he told his sister, but the ambulance was just getting there on the scene and the police had been there less than 5 minutes. Could they have shut down the lane in that length of time, or did Joey make two trips down that road? The timing is just too tight. Well, no, it's not, because we have the logs and we know for a fact that lane was shut down at 7:25 p.m. Here's Hank Jackson describing when and how the lane was shut down.
One lane blocked. Yep.
So what did you say?
The fire truck. One of us said one lane's blocked southbound. That lets dispatch know, because we had to block a state route like that. We had to notify DOT.
I see.
We're letting them know that there is one lane still available.
So, and the lane was blocked. Why?
Because for safety issues, for emergency personnel.
I see.
You don't want somebody running 60, 65, so, checking your pockets, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, 1926,
mm-hmm.
You call out one lane blocked. Does that mean the lane is blocked at 1926, or does that mean that's when you...
Okay, we get to call it 1920. At 1922, we're on scene, so it takes us 2 minutes there. And at 7:26, one of us advises that we have one lane blocked. And then,
does that mean that you blocked off the lane at 1926, or does that mean that at 1926 someone just happened to call and say the lane is blocked off?
Police is a multifaceted thing. Sometimes you have to prioritize the stuff you do, and you don't remember, you know, like when I pulled up, I don't say, I got one lane blocked. Not normally, because I'm thinking, hey, let me help this person, what we got. And then when I get a second, a breather, I say, hey, we got one lane blocked.
Okay.
Because dispatch needs to know that.
Now, the other big piece of evidence they use against Joey is that they claim Joey could not have recognized Isaac's truck when he passed it. Now, you heard Joey talking earlier, describing what he saw and how he recognized the truck. And according to him, he was going pretty slow when he passed it. They had one lane shut down. They had the cars going like single file, slow by. He had a good look at this truck and he thought he recognized it. From Tandy, we know that, well, she remembers anyway, that Joey called her and asked if Isaac's truck had a toolbox, indicating that he'd seen a toolbox and was trying to see if like maybe that matched what Isaac's truck had. But when Joey talks to Mike Key, one of the things he talks about is that brush guard. He says he knew Isaac's truck had a brush guard like that, and he could see one, or could see the lights, the headlights on, saw something as he passed. And at trial, this is Tammy Colston's huge argument for why Joey is a liar. He could not have recognized that truck, she says. There's no possibility that he could have known it was Isaac's truck that had gone off the road. Here's Marshall Smith at Mark's trial describing how the truck was positioned and why Joey could never have seen that brush guard.
Excuse me, Your Honor. This is State's Exhibit Number 4.
Thank you. That's the white Toyota pickup truck sitting up in the pine trees off the interstate there. And what you're looking at is the passenger side of the truck, along with the top and the fender there, and part of the bed.
All right. Now, insofar as the front of that truck, where is it? Where is it pointed and where is it lodged?
It's going up, it's headed up into the woods. In other words, the back end of the truck where the tailgate would normally be would be closest to the highway. The front end of the truck is up in the wood line.
All right, and which way, north or south, would it have been facing? Or could you sit?
Assume the highway runs due north and due south, which I know it doesn't, but that's what...
If the highway, if like Floyd College be going south, then the truck would be going west and east.
Okay, so more or less perpendicular
to that. Right, that's correct.
But Marshall Smith's the only one who describes the truck like this. I mean, other officers at the scene remember it going southbound. In fact, everyone who got there after the wreck initially assumed the car had been heading south because that's the direction the truck was pointing. It wasn't heading off to the west. It wasn't heading perpendicular to the road. It was in an angle south by southwestish, as if Isaac had been driving south and then had veered off slowly to the right. For instance, Hank Jackson has a very clear memory that would point to the truck being pointed more southwards than towards the west, perpendicular from the road, because when he got to the truck and tried to get to Isaac, he remembers going to the passenger side and not the driver's side out of concern that Isaac might potentially fall out of the car, because there was an incline there on the ditch. And because the car was positioned south by southwest, the passenger side was higher than the driver's side. Something that would not have happened if Marshall's memory about the truck being perpendicular were true.
The truck was, the guardrail's here, and it kind of goes down into like a little culvert, and then it goes back up to a bank, and the truck's kind of on the bank where the driver's side would kind of be downhill just a little bit. And I went to the passenger side because I could see him closer to the passenger side. So I went up there. Yeah. And I could see him over that side, so I just wanted to go over there to see, you know.
So, I mean, I have a couple thoughts about this. I mean, whether or not the truck was facing slightly south, or even if it was, like, perpendicular to the road, I mean, if you're driving down a road and there's a truck, you know, or a car perpendicular to it, and it's facing the other way, when you're coming at it at an angle, you still might be able to see, like, a brush guard. A brush guard, you know, it's kind of a big thing. It kind of comes over the edges of the front of the vehicle. And at an angle, you should still be able to see it. It's not like you're directly... you'd be directly behind the truck if you were the entire time, right? I mean, like, you could still, at a distance, maybe see it. And I don't think it would preclude Joey from seeing it either.
Here's the thing. This is, like, this is a cornerstone of the state's case. They are so reliant on this fact. This is their gotcha moment, their big reveal. And he couldn't have even known it was Isaac's truck when he made that call.
What we're looking right there at is a shot of this going north. Traffic going south would have seen the back of that truck. The front of that truck is in the trees. This is pointing south. Traffic would have been coming this way. That truck was turned around in such a fashion, it would have been very difficult, if not impossible, for someone to have seen a brush guard, which is what Joey told Mike Key. He knew it was Isaac's truck because he saw a brush guard on there. Why did he say that? He was trying to make an excuse. He was trying to come up for a reason of why he knew that it happened. He was trying to give himself, in effect, an alibi. Oh, yeah, I was there. I didn't see it happen, but I knew it was Isaac's truck. Well, that little small detail, though, that he knew it was by the brush guard, tends to make his story fall apart. And again, the reason being, cannot see that brush guard from the road, not in the direction that it is traveling.
But their proof for that? They have exactly two photos they took of Isaac's truck from the roadway. In one of the photos, it's taken from, I don't know, probably 10, 20 yards to the south, looking upwards. So you can't see much of anything. You see, like, the very back of the truck sticking out past the pine tree. I mean, you can see the weird blue striping thingies it's got on it, but it's a really bad image. It's a tiny, blurry white box. The second photo that they have of Isaac's truck in the woods, it's a little bit closer. It's got the car at least in frame, and it's looking southbound. But it almost makes me laugh every time I look at this, because this is their photo. This is their giant proof that Joey couldn't have seen a brush guard. And they're like, look at this photo, look at this truck. There's no brush guard visible. Well, the freaking driver's side door is open, and it's looking from the back left corner of the truck looking up, and the truck's kind of on a little rise, and the door is open. So it covers the entire front of the truck. Like, exactly where the brush guard would have been, exactly where it would have been visible, exactly where you expect to see it, there's a door open and in the way.
Well, it's a very convenient picture for the prosecution to use. I mean, it's like, oh, let us show you the one picture that would absolutely not allow you to be able to see the brush guard.
Yeah, or the one you could have will open the door so you can't see it. Like, if you, like, just look at the photo. I swear to God, if you look at the photo, you imagine that door being shut, you'd expect to see the headlight and the brush guard. And we also know from later photos taken in the Rome garage that the brush guard was falling off to the left side. In the wreck, it got smashed up. It was leaning out to the left. It was visible farther left than it normally would have been. So it would have been more visible than you'd typically expect. And I have a hard time thinking this is not deliberate, because everyone on Earth says over and over again that Clyde Collier takes so many photos. He takes so many photos. It's like a movie, they've said. And he only took two photos of the truck from the road, both of them conveniently positioned so that it's impossible to see the front. That doesn't seem believable to me.
Well, it's, I don't even really understand it that much anyway. I mean, the brush guard is big bars on the front of the truck, and you don't just have one vantage point if you're driving on the highway. You would see it as you're approaching it, and then once you pass it, you sort of see it from the side, and then you can look in your rearview mirror. So there's several different ways you could be looking at it, and you know, a brush guard is not something inconspicuous. It usually is bars sticking out prominently from the grill at the front of the truck, so it would really have to be extremely oddly positioned for someone from all the different vantage points not having a view of it at all from the road.
Now, if the truck had really been perpendicular to the road, like Marshall Smith testified, with its nose hidden in the pine trees, then sure, it might have been harder for, like, I could, you know, I'd see a way that argument could be made. But Marshall Smith is either, his testimony is based on the fact that he was never there before the truck was moved, or he's just lying because it's very, very apparent that that truck was not perpendicular. It was going south by southwest.
I mean, how could it be perpendicular? It's going northbound, and then it veers off into the southbound lane. Unless somehow his arm is turning the steering wheel after he's been shot, like, it's going to be at an angle. It's not going to be exactly perpendicular to the road.
Everyone who was there, like from the ambulance, from the cops, they all thought the truck was going southbound when they saw it. That indicates that they thought it was pointed south. I don't know. It's, to me, it's such an obvious issue that I almost want to, like, want to laugh at how much mileage Tammy Coulson got out of it, because it's a ridiculous argument, and she milked it for all it's worth based on two terrible photos. I don't know. I think everyone should go check out the one with the door open, because it really is hilarious to me. That's the evidence that you couldn't see the brush guard.
But this should be a sign that, you know, the reason that they're focusing on this argument so much is because this is the best they've got. I should tell you about the case.
It's the only physical evidence they have. It's the only evidence from the crime scene that they've got that can remotely support Joey's guilt.
And again, it's the state trying to claim that Joey's being too cute by half by asking his sister, does the vehicle have a toolbox, and mentioning the brush guard. And it's sort of getting caught up in his own lie, because there's no need for him to mention that, but he tripped up, is the state's claim. He mentioned the brush guard despite the fact that, according to his scenario of what happened that night, he couldn't have seen the brush guard. So it's trying to use Joey's potential compassion in calling his sister to relay the call to Isaac's sister against him and saying, well, no, this was actually a deviously plotted crime and you slipped up.
I mean, there's some interesting things going on here. I mean, you know, first of all, the state is, like, presenting so many things that I can just imagine that, you know, there's so much confusion, but the overall impression to a jury might be that, oh, wow, this guy's statements have changed so many times without maybe even the state being able to back up that, you know, assertion with any actual evidence that, oh, look, his statements change over and over, or the defense not being able to counter it effectively. But, you know, in the end, sometimes it's just about kind of like, what is the impression that you leave? And we mentioned this earlier, and we're going to talk about it in the future, but, like, even raising the prospect of Joey confessing to so many different people in so many different ways, that was done deliberately to create confusion in the case. I mean, what a very odd argument, and what a very odd strategy for any defendant to actually do.
And here's from the police notes. It says, didn't Joey tell someone that he made two trips past the accident? If so, who did he tell that to? This is important. Well, that's the precursor to what's going to argue at trial, which is that, oh, we know Joey lied because he told some friends he passed the wreck on his way down to Cedartown, and he told other friends he passed the wreck on his way back from Cedartown. Well, Isaac's truck was in the woods nearly 4 hours. I mean, he passed it going there and coming back. That's not some slip-ups or some scheme. It's just a fact. There's no way he could not have passed it twice. And yet they argue at trial, oh, look, he told this friend he passed it one time, and he told a different friend he passed it this time. He's lying.
So we can see how the state's case and theory of what happened here was very much like what you might see in a movie like Dial M for Murder. It was a case where the state claimed that Joey had elaborately plotted out this murder scheme for killing Isaac Dawkins, and yet inexplicably he was late. These phone calls he had meticulously set up to provide an alibi, in fact, only proved his guilt. And not only that, but somehow he was able to swap out a truck for a sedan wind up at a store buying a Gatorade when an accomplice who was supposed to be with him wasn't there, and then ended up a few minutes later at his girlfriend's house back in his truck. That is what the state had to sell to the jury, because it's the only theory of the case in which Joey could have committed this crime.
So what do you think? Does it seem likely or even possible that Joey could have murdered Isaac? Possible that it was premeditated even? If your answer is no, guess what? Not far into the investigation, the police didn't think so either. Next time on Undisclosed.
Episode 5 up and episode 5 down. 1 month in and you are all still around. Well done, folks, and thanks for your continued listenership. And of course, thanks to the Georgia Innocence Project at www.georgiainnocenceproject.org. Much love to our sponsors this week, Stamps.com and Great Courses, and new sponsor, Audible. We love those products. I tear through Audible books like it was my job. And we want you to love those products too. So check them out. And when you do, use promo code undisclosed. You'll get a sweet discount, and our sponsors will know that you heard about them from our program. They then say kind things to Audioboom, who say kind things to us. And in the end, we feel all warm and fuzzy. Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez with the theme music, Baluki with the logo, Nina Musser and Christy Williams with the website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com. Go to the website, get the transcripts and the people maps, and then go ask Susan questions about what you're hearing and seeing. She's at The View from LL2 on Twitter, and as always, happy to talk about the case. Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the podcast Crime Writers On is our producer. Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings associate produce the audio, and Methil Telhan produces pretty much everything else. So who's been hitting up the undisclosed Instagram account? I have. I'll be putting pictures of my dog up there soon, and maybe some of me in my Mack Weldon gear. Maybe. You can hit up Undisclosed on Instagram at UndisclosedPod, as well as Twitter and Facebook using that handle. Help us drive the discussion using hashtag Undisclosed, and don't forget to send your questions to John. He's over at The Addendum, and you can tweet him using hashtag UDAddendum. Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to your company next week. Until then.